Welcome back to another episode of Dan Has a Plan Beyond the Balance Sheet. I'm Daniel B. Smith, a certified financial planner on the Family Wealth Management team at UBS Financial Services. Our branch is located in Paramus, New Jersey, and I can be reached at daniel.b.smith@ubs.com. I'm joined by my daughter, Alana J. Smith.
Hi, everyone.
Our guest today is Dr. Farah White. Farah is a doctor of psychiatry, and she is here to talk to us about mental health and planning for a well-balanced life. She is not affiliated with UBS Financial Services, and her views are her own.
She's awesome, and she was so more than happy to answer all of our big questions. You talk about mental health in every financial plan?
I ask clients, what brings them happiness? That's my way of asking about their mental health. How is their outlook?
And lately, how are people doing?
Yeah. I would say the last year, obviously, we have new representation in Washington. It's caused more connectivity to financial planning than probably ever before.
Really? Yeah. People are really keying in?
People are keying in because there's a lot of unknowns right now.
People are gravitating to what they think they can control.
Yeah. And I promote that because there's a saying, you know, tune out the noise, whether you're shooting a free throw in a raucous gym trying to make it, or if you're trying to raise a family of four on one income, you got to just boil it down to minute by minute, hour by hour, day by day, and embrace that.
Yeah. And we'll talk about this with Dr. Farah White in the episode, but preventatively treating your mental health is to bring balance and peace to your life.
Yeah, that's the challenge of everybody that walks the earth, earthly.
The uniquely human experience.
And everybody has their own vantage point.
All right, so you ready for an Ask Dan question?
I'm ready.
Okay, thank you, listener, for writing in. They say, Dan, I am financially stable, but money still causes me a lot of anxiety. Is there a number that will bring me security or peace of mind?
The answer is no.
I knew you were going to say no. I should have just written back and said, no, there's no number. No, tell us why.
There's no number. Having done thousands of financial plans, there are people that just will not believe that they can spend what I say they can spend. And that if I do say that, they'll spend less or they'll spend more. There is no number. It has to be complemented by a balanced life. If your only focus is on the number, that's not healthy. It's really not healthy. And the number having to last 10, 20, 70 years, whatever it is. Here's an example. You get a job. You love your job, but the job doesn't pay a lot. I focus on the fact that you like the job. Some of my wealthiest clients do not make a lot of money, but they're so happy with what they're doing. You know, they can piece together a few bucks a month to go into their 401k or to reduce debt or whatever their goals are, knowing that, hey, you know, the majority of my day, I'm going to be working at something I really love to do. And to me, that's a total win.
Yeah. So mental health and finances, super intertwined.
Super intertwined. There was a time in my life when I was a father, a husband, and we had just had our third child. And I wanted desperately for my wife, Susan, to be able to, you know, spend a good year and a half to 2 years with my youngest, our new baby, Benjamin.
Right, because she was a working mom. She was a physical therapist.
Yeah. You and Janine were five and eight years old at the time. So the best thing for my family at that time was for my wife to be at home.
And she wanted that.
That was the goal. Losing her income at that juncture of our life would have hurt, but I was motivated to plug that gap. In preparation for that, I became a basketball referee. I built up a very heavy schedule, so I was able to do that. Then I also got a part-time job from 3:30 a.m. to 5:30 a.m. daily, being a adult paper route.
Delivery man.
Delivery man. I did that for 2 years.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah. And the only thing I sacrificed during that 2 year period was sleep. And to me, I would never have traded that for anything in the world. This is before I got into the brokerage industry. When you want something, you have to create a path.
So this is good because I think a lot of times mental health can come as like a, well, yeah, it would be nice if I could think about my mental health, but I have so much going on. So yeah. At the time, how did you stay grounded?
I stayed grounded because I just saw the joy that Sue and I had knowing that our family was connected. I think at that point in our lives, the five of us, we created a bond that could never be replaced, as evidenced by some recent home movies we watched together.
Yeah.
You'll see that I was present, a little sleepy, but I was present.
Oh, big time, big time. Yeah. I think we should share one of those videos with this episode. I think that would be good. There's some really nice dancing that happens.
Well, this episode of Dan Has a Plan will cover a lot of areas.
Yeah.
So it's going to be hopefully one of our best.
Yeah. So let's welcome
the Dr. Farah White.
Dan
we are blessed to have the Dr. Farrah White with us today.
Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you guys so much for having me on. Very excited.
We're very excited to talk to you.
This is her 45 minutes of free time of the week.
Yep, we're stealing it.
Okay. We always start from the beginning. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Bergen County, New Jersey.
Familiar.
went to school there for the first 15 years of my life, then went to boarding school in New Hampshire.
Wow, got out of town.
Yeah, I did. And it was before we had so much connectivity. My first year at school was the first year that people actually had phones in their rooms. Previously, there was like one phone for the entire dorm, like a payphone.
Oh, watershed moment.
It really was.
Wait, and so what grade was this?
10th grade.
Wow.
Yeah. And so I went all through my schooling, not thinking that I was going to be a psychiatrist. My parents are both in the mental health field, but I thought like, oh, I'm going to do something else. I'll probably move to Paris. I was studying art history. And then when I was a sophomore in college, 9/11 happened.
Wow.
So that was like a huge turning point.
And where was college? Yeah,
at Tufts.
I love the nickname of Tufts, the Jumbos.
Yeah, the Jumbos, that's fun. I know. It's a good mascot.
So you go to college, what, undecided?
I was majoring in something that was sort of similar to art history.
Okay.
Like a visual studies major. And then I thought maybe I want to do something in the mental health field or the medical field, but it was a little bit late to try to course correct. And so I finished college, worked for a couple of years as a research assistant, went back and took a whole bunch of classes and then took more classes. And then I started med school 5 years later.
Mercy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
I knew that I wanted to go into psychiatry. So I did a residency. That was tough because I was commuting into the city.
Okay.
So that was super challenging, but also very gratifying.
Then residency for three.
For four.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So. Yeah. So it's a really long path. For me, I knew what I was going to do eventually. So I just tried to enjoy whatever opportunities I had to learn something new.
So med school for you, because you're in the mental health field, was it the rotation of OBGYN and cardiology,
yeah,
the whole thing?
You have to do it all.
Oh, my God.
See, there's a little fun fact.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. You're sitting in an open heart surgery, but you're going to be a psychiatrist.
Right. I also feel like, on the other hand, the orthopedic surgeon who's replacing, you know, knees and hips every day has had to rotate through psychiatry.
Okay.
Mm. Probably a good thing people don't specialize and subspecialize too early.
Because you never know, you might be pivoting.
Exactly.
You might be pivoting.
I thought that, you know, oh, if I'm not happy here or if there's not enough work, but then there's a global mental health crisis. Yeah.
A little bit of work. Yeah. So wow. What made you say psychiatry is the path for me?
Because it was a little bit more structured and we were right near UMDNJ. The psychology program at Rutgers, I think, is a little bit farther down, and it's, I think, in some ways longer and a little bit less linear.
To me, it's almost unusual for someone to provide mental health therapy, yeah, and also be able to prescribe.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. I think that some people look for that. I have special training in therapy. The healthcare system doesn't really support it and insurance doesn't really reimburse for it. But there are some reasons why people might do better having a psychiatrist as their therapist. And so one reason could be they have something like bipolar disorder, schizoaffective disorder, schizophrenia, and they need their meds managed, like a lot of oversight.
Okay.
Right. So those people might not be the best candidates to see a psychiatrist every other month. And then the other possibility is people who are young and who are dealing with things like Crohn's disease, Ehlers-Danlos, like chronic illnesses, where having a therapist who has a medical background is actually really helpful for them.
Right.
Can you talk generally about what you do?
Day to day, I have a few different offices. I'll go see patients, and most of my day is treating people for depression and anxiety. I also do a lot of work with ADHD and I would say sort of less common psychiatric issues. I have supervision groups, I have my own therapy, I have individual supervisors, and then things like, you know, my own podcast or sort of collaborative. We don't have actual case conferences, but a big part of my day is talking to people that I share patients with. So they might be the primary therapist and I might be just like, okay, how are they doing?
That sounds like a full day.
Yeah.
Must be some napping in there somewhere.
Yeah, I wish.
As an overlay here, obviously, I do financial planning. You know, there's many parts of a financial plan that are important. There's obviously the money part. There is liability management, insurance management, but there's the person. I always talk about happiness.
Yeah.
Okay. Just to go back a little bit, I was born in 1960. I remember growing up and I wasn't exposed to anything for mental health, like positive mental health. How have you seen it evolve?
Because of people's declining mental health.
Do you think mental health has declined more recently than it was, say, 40 years ago?
1,000%.
Okay.
Like, the numbers are actually terrifying. I don't know them off the top of my head, but it's probably a good thing.
It's for the best.
Yeah, it really is. And we know that pre-digital age, people just had much better mental health. There were things that were not as good. We weren't as aware of, let's say, the damage that things like bullying caused. Now we know, but social media overall has had like a really deleterious effect on people's overall well-being.
I used to be connected all the time, and I found that this was a kind of a change I made personally. When I left the office, I turned off both my personal and corporate cell phone. I feel happier because of it. Yeah. You know, I feel rested.
Right.
So when you talk about depression, I know social media is a contributing factor, but what causes depression?
So we're not exactly sure. There's a genetic link. Usually the story goes that people, as they are entering sort of a middle childhood, run into difficult moments. And there are things that can, you know, set people down a more difficult path. But yeah, we're not sure why some people get depressed, some don't. There are a lot of theories. And we're also not sure why some people get better and some people can't. Most people do get better. Most people can have a few months or even a few years, but they do really well with treatment.
Are you seeing depression across all age groups?
I used to focus more on like emerging adulthood, like 18 to 24. And now I would say most of my patients have gotten a little bit older. And I really like actually working with people in their 70s.
Wow. I assume that that's coupled with anxiety. Is that part of it?
It can be. And I think one of the biggest questions, sometimes people will come in and they present with a lot of anxiety and we treat the anxiety and then they feel really down because they're sort of connecting with the part of themselves that was sad and the anxiety and the adrenaline sort of got them up and moving. I would say that both of them are equally dangerous if they go untreated.
You hear the term high functioning anxiety a lot. I guess this is a two-part question. Is one, what are the signs that a high functioning person with anxiety might want to seek any kind of help? And also, are there different styles or different approaches for people who have been moving through the world really conditioned a level of anxiety that they feel comfortable with?
Yeah, certainly. I see a lot of high achievers, right? So one side of that coin is that they are the first people in the morning, the last people to leave the office. Mm-hmm. They are just on point. But the other side of that is that sometimes they're driven by anxiety. A common question is, well, I don't want to treat my anxiety because then I'm going to underperform.
Yeah, it's working for me.
Yeah, it's working for them until it stops working, right? Until, let's say, something goes wrong, a deal slips, and then they start to spiral. And it can look very different in different people. But one thing that I look for is functional impairment. So if someone says, well, I read my emails through just for like a tone check, and then I send them off, that's pretty normal. If someone says, well, I read my emails 5 times, then I send them to 3 friends for a tone check. And then, but then I spend 20 minutes looking at all the emails that I sent to make sure that, you know, I didn't CC the wrong person. That is going to impair their functioning. Other things that you might see at work that can really like detract from someone's performance are reassurance seeking, because they want to hear, oh no, this is how it's done. Yes, you did it the right way. Good job. And depending on the workplace, you may not get that reassurance, mm-hmm. right? And it's a huge energetic drain. One way that we're sort of similar is when I look at, okay, how can I help someone? Maybe I can't make them feel happy because I'm not a magician, so, right? But I can get them to feel comfortable and to work towards a well-balanced life. That, I think, is probably what you do when you're working with people. It's just like, okay, well, what do you need to put into something in order to get the desired result?
Yeah. You know, the planning process is all encompassing. People share with me some very intimate inner thoughts mm-hmm. about their lives, about their family, how they're brought up. And one of the major hurdles I have with clients is when they're cusping to retire, there's a huge mental decision they have to make. I can show them for the previous 5 years that we're trending towards retirement, you can retire. And I never say that Dan says you can retire. The plan says you can retire. Okay. just to make it perfectly clear. here to the listeners. Let that be the voice of reason. But as people do retire, I will call them and say, listen, how are you transitioning? Because there's hurdles.
Right.
Time management, how to live a balanced life. You've mentioned balanced life. I've been accused of working 7 days a week and three or four nights. When's the balance going to come?
Right.
And okay. I take after him. So, oh, you know. But I think also part of what you're asking is, like you mentioned, working with some patients in their 70s. What is that transition like? And do you have any kind of useful tools that people could take away?
I think it's really emotional and that it's not always tied to their financial situation, because people who work a lot, they tend to enjoy their jobs or enjoy something about it. Maybe it's the camaraderie, having a place to go. And when they don't have that anymore, it's really hard for them to find their place in the world. And if their identity is really, really tied to being in finance or a doctor or a lawyer, and they've been doing that for 50 years, right? And all of a sudden they're not doing it anymore. I mean, it's a huge adjustment.
Yeah, it is.
In the medical field, you talk about prevention is the best medicine.
Yeah.
Can you speak on that in therapy world?
Sure. So the first thing, anytime someone's feeling unsafe, right? That's like our equivalent of chest pain. Like you've got to get to see someone. Other things, if they're finding that there's any appetite or sleep disturbance, if they just don't enjoy things, that's a big one. It's called anhedonia. And it might be like, oh, you've been waiting to go to this concert. You get there and it's just, you might as well be in bed.
Wow. That's got to be hard to identify.
It's hard if you don't know what questions to ask. And luckily, you don't have to be a psychiatrist, well-trained social workers, LMHCs. Everybody's going to ask those same questions and they'll ask the right questions to identify, okay, this person needs treatment. And then it's a matter of what kind of treatment to get. When we think about like what's out there, lots of companies that are doing this on a grand scale, it becomes challenging because people may end up with more treatment than they need or not exactly the right treatment.
There's an idea of over-therapizing or like making terms colloquial.
Right. So if you go to someone like me who's usually got a wait list and I'm not trying to be a mogul, I'll tell people, hey, listen, you don't need to see me every week. Why don't I see you in 2 or 3 weeks? But if you are trying to support a gigantic company and make money for investors, and like it becomes different, right? And it's a commodity and it's about supply and demand. And so we're never going to try to diminish the demand for it. So that is a consideration, right?
Yeah, I noticed going to, even for my annual physical, they asked me mental health questions.
Right. Now, and so, it's good that they screen because they're picking up cases that wouldn't otherwise be picked up. Those measures have been studied and researched, and people who are giving you those measures know what to do if you screen positive. It's a little bit different from, let's say, going online. Okay, you feel sad, click here, and now you're going to be in therapy 3 times a week. Or now you're going to be texting with your therapist, right? Because what does that do to someone's development?
Right. Yeah. You're talking about constantly needing reassurance.
Right. Yeah.
It just feeds the beast.
Exactly. Exactly.
Generally, there's someone in your life that you know could use someone like yourself, but it has to be a voluntary thing. Any recommendations?
Yeah, I think people are scared. So psychiatry has kind of a dark history. Before all of the mental hygiene laws, there were psychiatrists who did some bad things or kept people in hospitals who may not have needed to be there. Now patients have a lot of rights. They really don't have to engage in care if they don't want to, unless there's a court order, because there are risks to themselves or someone else.
Right.
But what I tell people who are a little bit nervous to come in, they say, well, it's all confidential. You can just get information and you don't have to do anything with that. Like, no one's going to force someone who's down to take medicine that they don't want, but I will give people lots of options of how they can get better.
You know, you mentioned a global mental health crisis.
Yeah.
What's making you optimistic about mental health in 2026?
I think it's moving really fast. For a long time, we would see other fields making huge strides. I would feel a little bit like, where is psychiatry in all of this?
Yeah, you're like redheaded stepchild.
Yeah, totally.
Meanwhile, everybody has a brain.
Right. So I think we're getting more good people into the field. We're gaining understanding of how the mind works every day. There are awesome researchers just kind of working on this and getting the word out. It does feel almost insurmountable at times like this, you know, when the world is in this kind of a state, because one thing that I deal with a lot is PTSD and trauma and what is happening when everybody is traumatized over and over. It's hard.
Yeah. It's not just people coming out of the military, right? There's other PTSD.
Yeah.
Can you speak to, we're just touching everything today. Yeah. Can you speak to seasonal affective disorder? Because
sure.
Now that we're in the winter, it's going to come out in February.
Yes.
People are having a tough time.
Yes. If people feel really down during the winter because they're just not getting enough sunlight.
Yeah.
And they're not getting out and they can't do the things that they enjoy. The most important thing that people can do to understand what they're dealing with, what they're feeling, is really to try to track it, to try to track when their mood starts to dip and why, and also when it starts to get better. One big treatment for it is light therapy. So that can be super helpful and it's easy to do. You can buy a light right on Amazon. There are small things that can, I would say, make it much better.
Is there anything dietary that can help?
Yes. There are a lot of theories about that. In the mental health field, we think that just like super high levels of inflammation and processed foods actually have a negative effect on mental health. That is a tricky one. And there's a whole field of nutritional psychiatry.
And it's fascinating.
Yeah. And a mind-gut connection. I think one of the things that's really tough is for people who are on their own to try to cook in a certain way. It's a challenge. A lot of times, the people who are most capable of being able to exercise, eat right, sleep right, they're not the ones who are struggling the most.
Right.
Got it. One of the things that I did, I went to speak to a therapist for a couple of years. I just wanted to understand, to unwind my past. I struggled with why I am.
Mm-hmm.
But it was really the informational highway. That may be a little bit outside the box, but maybe not.
It's not, actually. So people come to therapy
Thank you for that.
for a couple of reasons. You know, they'll come sometimes if they're struggling. Sometimes they will come in to examine their own habits and relationships. And sometimes that's actually where people make the most progress because, let's say, when you go to a really good therapist, what they're doing is they're taking everything that you say and they're putting it in the context of what they know about you, what they know about your childhood, what they know about certain patterns. The goal is to really reflect it back to you so that you understand your sense of self. Oh, why did it bother me so much that, you know, someone cut me off on the road? Well, people cut me off all the time when I was growing up and no one listened to me, right? And that, I think, is the gift that a good round of therapy can give anyone, is knowing that our reactions and responses are connected to something, some imprint from our childhood, and that if we understand them, we're just so much better off in the world. And because of what I do, I feel like I have the benefit of saying, wow, I'm really angry about that. And instead of just staying angry, I just try to do that detective work.
And the end goal being balance, I guess,
peace, I would say, because it's like, how do we accept certain things about ourselves? Let's say people who are really rigid, like, no, we just can't eat outside the kitchen. And sometimes, even though they seem really rigid, they feel bad about that. They want to be more relaxed and they don't understand why they can't be.
We see a lot of resources and places for women to go and gather and talk about mental health. And in general, if I'm making a sweeping generalization, it's just easier for women to approach the subject. Mm-hmm. How are we reaching the men of 2026?
It's difficult. I think about getting people the right kind of help and intervention. Everybody needs community and it looks different based on age, gender, so many factors. In general, we're not meant to be isolated. So any kind of togetherness is a protective factor. So even if people go to play basketball twice a week, but they're not talking about their feelings, it doesn't matter because it's still good for them. You're right that women tend to be more open. And I think that the benefit of that is that people can share knowledge and feel less alone. So that's the risk, is that people are going through something, they don't understand it, all of a sudden they just don't want to get out of bed and they think, well, I must be lazy. This is a character defect instead of this is a depressive episode. And that's the one thing that all the information has given us.
So speaking of balance, you're married, you're a mom, you're an aunt, you have parents, you have patients.
Right.
How does it all balance?
I think I'm pretty lucky to have a lot of very important relationships. But most of the people that I work with, you know, most of my patients know and understand that and are very supportive. I would say my kids hopefully are proud of what I do. And even though sometimes I'm sure they wish I were around a bit more, this is the situation. Nobody necessarily thought it would be this busy, but it is. And I think it's just asking for a little bit of compassion from people. I don't do everything perfectly all the time. And in fact, I mess up quite a bit, but I've learned just to kind of like keep it moving. And when something is hard, I'll certainly bring it up. Like, I'm having a tough time with this and here's why. I feel like if we share whatever it is we're struggling with just in the moment, not in like a heavy way, but just, hey, something's going on with my dad. Most of my patients are like, oh, okay, just get back to me when you can, and really supportive and wonderful.
Something that we talk about a lot is just the emotional tie to money and the shame that can come up sometimes, mm-hmm. especially around things like debt. Maybe both of you can tag team this question, mm-hmm. but how can you encourage a safe space around money, and given the fact that it changes? Mm-hmm. I would put money on the fact mm-hmm. that it comes up.
Yeah.
I mean, I deal with a lot of mid-20-year-olds mm-hmm. that are coming out of college with huge debt, and they feel depressed about it, ashamed about it, uninformed, things like that. And there's always a path, okay? And what I try to do is I break it down to kind of like a box of cereals. We do it one Cheerio at a time. Mm-hmm. That's how you eat Cheerios, okay?
This coming from the man who taught me how to eat a Cheerio is pretty good.
Yeah. And on the flip side of that, a lot of people are afraid of money, that they've accumulated so much that they're saying, do I really deserve this?
Mm. You know, you don't think about that.
Yeah. So what I try to do is financially, therapeutically through mm-hmm. the plan, soften some borders of that to make the idea flow so it's collaborative. Yeah, let's go through this together. So that's how I would do it. If someone came to you with, they went bankrupt, mm-hmm. okay, and there's a lot of shame with that.
Yeah.
And it's making them depressed. They don't want to get out of bed. And I always say, listen, the sun rises, the sun sets, and you only can do what you can do.
Exactly. And how do we know when we've done enough, right? To have a healthy relationship with anything, we don't want to think about it in its largest form, right? If we're talking about, let's say, disordered eating, disordered spending, or even, let's say, deprivation, saving too much, I think looking at, okay, how is it that we want to feel? What feels right? People have such, I would say, trauma and anxiety about finances. And I think that's something that I learned from a supervisor, to really try to take a financial history. One, because therapy can be very expensive and we don't want it to cause financial strain. It's not always covered by insurance. And so that's tricky. But also because some people might be really off base. And actually, I refer a lot to financial planners, because I will say, no, you have to think about a budget that makes sense. And then you actually, for some people, have to spend in that budget. If you have, let's say, $500 a year that you can spend on entertainment, go see a Broadway show or something.
Right. That is your medicine
right,
for the week.
Exactly. Yeah. And don't deprive yourself because your financial planner has said it's okay. Right. So when people can't think rationally about things, that's where we need an expert who's objective to come in and say, hey, this is what it's okay to spend, or this is what you need to save.
So medication, I just wanted mm-hmm. to go over that a little bit.
Yeah. So we're always looking at whether something is sort of symptom control. People are going to have a panic attack, they take it. It's not what we call disease modifying. Like the GLPs, for example, really have been shown to help in a lot of ways. Like that's just what the research says. It doesn't mean, though, that we should take a 23-year-old and put them on any medicine, right? The things that we should be looking at are multifactorial and very complex, and our healthcare system doesn't always allow for that full evaluation.
Right.
So people get put on medication as kids, a lot of them, and then they are taught to believe they need it because it becomes like the thing in the family, like, oh, take your medicine. Not everybody needs it. They don't need it all the time. But the other ways, if we talk about, like, yeah, if we could all optimize for sleep, for diet, for social connection, then there would be a lot less medicine prescribed, probably. It's just the way that our healthcare system works is, for a lot of doctors, if they don't write a prescription, it's like, what is the patient even doing there?
That's scary.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's connected to what you were saying before about the companies that are doing broad outreach, mm-hmm. I guess, to patients, yeah. is like the need is always there.
Right.
These are just topics that I see every day. And one of them is overuse injuries, meaning that kids are playing soccer 12 months a year. On the outside, you think soccer, kids are running, it's good aerobically, they're with a group of people, it's collaborative, but there's head injuries, there's mm-hmm. there's ankles. Are you treating people for sport balance? Does that come up?
I think it's just a general finding out, okay, well, what is appropriate and at what age? We see a lot of parenting that's very aggressive. So as parents, we are shepherds. We're not engineers. In today's world, everyone wants to give their kid a leg up, and they believe that by putting a 3-year-old in soccer, right, that's going to give them the leg up. It's not appropriate for a three-year-old to do anything at a professional level, right?
Exactly.
Maybe not. We are biologically and physiologically programmed not to be able to do certain things at certain ages, right? We don't start gymnastics when we're 45 years old because we would get an injury. The same way, there's things that people who are four shouldn't do. And I think that people have to use their own best judgment and not push kids out of a place of fear.
That's great advice.
Coming from a professional.
Yeah. I know.
It's hard because I think that the people who are pushing their kids, they want the best for them. There's a lot of content out there that says, well, this is the best. So don't you want your kid to have it?
Yeah, my personal diatribe on that is that, you know, I happen to have some experience with sports and, you know, I played all the sports growing up. I honed in on baseball in college. And at that point, I thought I was a very, very good baseball player. And I thought I'd be a professional baseball player. This is the transformation I've seen from that is that people are holding their kids back from going into kindergarten a year. You know, I call it redshirt kindergartners.
Yeah.
All right. You know, they're getting private lessons when they're four and five and 6 years old for something. Yeah. And, you know, it just frustrates me because people are living 90, 100, 110 years now. You've got a whole life to prepare for, not just this little micro section. And that's what I try to promote with the financial plan is that, listen, playing just for today, you know, like I'll meet with a 75-year-old. You've got, at least chronologically speaking, another 25 years here.
Yeah.
All right. So let's be smart about things.
Let's plan.
I know in your profession, there has to be something that provided you an aha moment. And it can be a small thing. Like I had an aha moment recently where a woman who was in independent living decided to go to memory care. Through a lot of support and help, she made that decision. And that was an aha moment for me.
When I work with new moms, those are my biggest aha moments. Having a newborn is so taxing, you know, and a lot of times they're like recovering from a difficult pregnancy or delivery, but that ability to get whatever care and support you need to stay present and to enjoy what is a really, really short but very special time in their lives and in their baby's lives. And so that to me, I don't know if it's necessarily one aha moment, but it's just generally a very inspiring thing.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And it makes me feel like all the training and everything, you know, was really worth it because it's giving the woman who's worked really hard for this experience a better time. And then we know that there are benefits to the baby.
Two for one.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, that's such a great point too. Being able to have the courage to find help during postpartum time, which women are, I think, finally feeling emboldened to admit that it's just really hard. Yeah.
So Alana Jay, this is the Dr. Farrah White.
Thank you, Dr. White. Yeah,
thank you both so much for having me.
Yeah, it was our honor. Thank you.
Yeah. Be well.
She's a dynamo.
We could have talked for hours.
She has what I call the rare combination of intelligence and street smarts. She just can relate to anybody.
Yeah, a superpower.
That's a gift. She's probably seen more than many of us will see in a lifetime when it comes to her field, but I'm so thankful there's people in the world like her.
And thank you for sharing a little bit about your mental health journey.
You know, when you get to your mid-50s into your late 50s, and you know, you start to be reflective. I just couldn't figure out some answers to things, and I needed someone to kind of walk me through it.
That objective perspective.
Yeah, and it helped me in all areas of my life. It helped me with my relationships that I have. It helped me with my family. It helped me with my career, and it helped my health. You know, I was buzzing through my life, and I needed to just take a pause to understand some things. Mm-hmm. And devoting some time to it was, and not to be corny, but it was therapeutic. So it really made me talk about my past, you know, my childhood, my early years into my 20s was the area I focused on.
Mm-hmm.
And it was helpful, very helpful.
Did you feel a greater sense of self-worth afterwards?
Yeah, it just slowed me down. I have a great deal of empathy for people in general. I may not show it outwardly, but I try to do it in my actions.
I think you're pretty good at showing it.
Doing this podcast, I never thought we'd be kind of going down this path, talking about topics like this, but it's part of planning. It may not be financial money planning, but you can have all the money you want. But if you're not happy, that has to be a component. You have to have that.
Yeah. And you mentioned in the episode, we talk a little bit about the stress of money. And I think one of the things that you've really taught me is that there's always a solution. There's always a first step to take.
Yeah. And Farrah mentioned it in the episode that impulsivity is, I would say, listen, if you're playing a fast-paced basketball game, you've got to be impulsive and do things. But when it comes to life and decision-making, it's good to talk to the community that you're in, talk to professionals in your community for whatever you're trying to accomplish. It just helps you kind of strain through, you know, kind of like a colander. Let the water go through that's creating the noise, and what's left is the pasta. That's what we should be enjoying. Okay.
So. Yep. How's that for a metaphor?
Yeah. Well, we got them.
All right. So bon appetit, everyone, and wishing you a balanced month this February.
The lover's month, February.
Okay. Well, I love you.
I love you.
Presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services Incorporated offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services Incorporated is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.